Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh, and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing their roles, lives, and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 17, Sunday, May the 25th, 2008. Gamma ray astronomy. As the most energetic photons, gamma rays are rare, difficult to observe, require special telescopes and detectors, and not many of them make it to the surface of the Earth anyway. So why is gamma ray astronomy important? Like much of the electromagnetic spectrum, the Earth's atmosphere blocks gamma rays, but the blue light they trigger by the gamma ray interaction high up in the atmosphere does make it to the surface, and that's what the ground-based gamma ray telescopes detect. The cosmic events in the vicinity of supernovae, black holes and binary pulsars which give rise to such emissions are rare, and detecting these blue flashes, which only last a few nanoseconds, require a sophisticated technological solution. In 1958, Pavel Cherenkov received a Nobel Prize for discovering that charged particles, electrons or protons, in an insulator could be accelerated by gamma rays to such a high speed where they would emit a characteristic blue light. This high speed is not greater than the speed of light, but since it's higher than the speed that light would travel in that medium, in this case air, it is often quoted as being faster than speed of light. It's not an area of astronomy that amateur astronomers dip even their big toe in, and something entirely new for me. Talking jointly with Dr. Stella Bradbury and Dr. Joachim Rosa at the Department of Physics, University of Leeds, was a little scary, but it turned out to be extremely informative. I spoke to them a couple of weeks ago, and incidentally, the reference to the launch of the Gamma Ray Large Area Telescope, GLAST, has been delayed now to June the 3rd. Dr. Joachim Rosa and Dr. Stella Bradbury, very warm welcome to both of you to AstroTalk UK. Now, are you astrophysicists or particle physicists?
Well, we're more sort of astro-particle physicists.
Which is ideal, because the area that you specialise in is gamma-ray astronomy.
That's right. Very, very high-energy radiation.
What exactly are gamma rays?
Well, they're not much different from normal light, except that they carry an enormous amount of energy. If you can think of normal light to consist of photons, and gamma rays are just the same, they are photons. Now, the big difference is that each photon packs an enormous amount of energy, right, about a million times more than a photon that you would normally observe with an optical telescope.
So it's a really extreme end of the electromagnetic spectrum.
It's probably the highest possible photon energy that we will ever be able to observe.
If you think about visible light, it doesn't really do you any harm, and that sort of packs one unit of energy in. And then you think about ultraviolet light, you're going up in energy a bit, that will burn your skin. Mm-hmm. And you get to X-rays, which will go through your skin and give you a shadow of your bones, and they've got sort of about 1,000 units of energy on that scale.
Right.
And then the gamma rays that you get from radioactive decay, that people say, if you had a barium meal in a hospital, you were detecting the radiation from that, those gamma rays would have an energy of about 1,000,000 units.
Well.
Okay. There aren't very many of them.
Right.
And then our gamma rays have an energy of 1,000,000,000 units. Okay. So we can't really make them on Earth.
X-rays can be dangerous. Is there any danger involved in the kind of work you do? From
No, absolutely not. It's perfectly safe because these gamma rays, because they carry such an enormous energy, they can't actually reach us. They immediately, when they reach the upper parts of the Earth's atmosphere, they interact. They collide with the air molecules they find, and they never actually reach the ground.
Mm. Oh, okay, so we'll talk about how gamma ray telescopes work, Earth-based ones, in a moment. But first, how long has gamma ray astronomy been around?
Ooh, now there's an interesting question. I guess the Cherenkov light that comes from gamma rays and things was first detected around about 1956 or so by some people experimenting at Harwell. But they weren't able to do astronomy with it. It was late 1960s, people predicted that maybe some objects out there, say the remnants of supernova explosions, would actually be producing gamma rays. So then people thought it was worthwhile trying to look for them. They built, one of the telescopes we use was built in 1968, so slightly older than I am, always like to emphasise that. But actually, using that telescope, it was 21 years before they actually found something, because they kept trying, and they kept having to modify the telescope, add bits to it, and develop a technique. So really, I guess the first source was properly detected in 1989.
Gamma ray astronomy, because of the huge energies you indicated, they must be associated with the astronomical events which are inherently quite energetic.
Yes. Violence in the universe is what we're looking for, I'm afraid.
Right.
So they're not thermal gamma rays. They're not. Right. If you heat something up, you're never really managing to get to a temperature that will give you gamma rays.
It really takes the most extreme processes that we know of, that we can think of in the universe, to produce gamma rays, which, looking at it the other way, this makes these gamma rays so interesting to us, because we're using them as a tool to actually understand some very extreme environments.
So these would be supernovae, neutron stars, black holes,
yes,
that sort of thing.
Yes, one extreme environment is a rapidly spinning neutron star, which the magnetic field around that neutron star will essentially lead to particles being accelerated to some extreme energies. Uh-huh. And these high energy particles eventually collide with a photon.
Right.
And that photon, because of this collision, receives an enormous amount of energy, and it's that photon that we then later on detect on Earth.
Mm. You indicated that the photons may be travelling millions of light years in space, but then come to a last few miles before they reach us. They interact with the air molecules high up in the atmosphere, so they never make it. So what do you actually detect on the ground-based telescopes?
Obviously a good question. How do we detect anything? Yeah. It turns out that, yes, the photons do interact with the atmosphere, but the result of this interaction is that the photon, which carries an enormous amount of energy, converts some of this energy, a small fraction of it, into creating particles, electrons and positrons. So we're turning energy into matter.
Right.
And that process behaves like an avalanche. This happens repeatedly. The photon loses more and more energy, more and more electrons get created. The electrons themselves generate even more photons. They can radiate photons. And in the end, you have a shower, an avalanche of particles somewhere 8 kilometers high up in the atmosphere.
About where you would be on a transatlantic flight.
Right.
Right. Now, that shower itself, in principle, you don't know that it's there.
Right.
However, these particles travel at a speed which is higher than the speed of light, which is, of course, not allowed.
I knew this was going to be heavy. Carry on.
I should say they travel at a speed which is higher than the speed of light in air.
I see.
In air, right. The speed of light is just slightly lower than in vacuum.
Right.
And there is as a consequence,
right.
The particles start to emit radiation, which is essentially light, which we know as Cherenkov light.
Right.
Because Cherenkov was the man who first explained, predicted this effect.
Is there any danger from these particles to people traveling in aircraft?
People are monitored, and flight crew are monitored for the amount of radiation dosage they get, and there is a certain limit set that they can't fly more than a certain number of hours. Uh-huh. For your average traveller, no, you're fine.
Okay, so going back to this journey, these gamma rays from the other end of the universe have arrived, hit the atmosphere, and they create this avalanche of particles. Although they're travelling slower than the speed of light, they're travelling faster than they should be doing, and hence they get to the ground?
They may. If there's a lot of energy from the original photon, the shower may actually reach the ground. But typically, no, the shower does not reach the ground. You get the largest number of particles at about aircraft altitude, 8 kilometres up.
Right.
And then a few kilometers further down, the particles basically eventually get stopped by the atmosphere.
Oh.
But the light that they emit doesn't get stopped, which is essentially blue light.
Right.
So what we're actually looking for with our very large telescopes, we're looking for a very brief flash of blue light somewhere in the night sky.
In fact, there's a calculation done by Blackett, who worked out that about 0.01% of the total night sky background light is due to this Cherenkov radiation from charged cosmic ray particles. Not just from gamma rays, but from other charged particles that come into the atmosphere.
Right.
Yeah, so we can essentially see it as part of the night sky background light. We'll probably be picking up some Cherenkov photons in our eyes, but we can't see a flash because it happens too quickly. Essentially, the light arriving at our telescope only lasts for as long as the shower of particles lasts in the atmosphere. And that is about 1,000 millionth of a second.
We work very differently from how one would normally work in astronomy. If one wants to, say, take an optical image of a galaxy, basically what is done is to open the shutter for a certain number of seconds, say for a minute, and take an image. We are in a very different situation. First of all, the image, the picture that we want to take, is only present for a few nanoseconds. Secondly, nobody actually tells us that this image is present. Nobody tells us when to open the shutter, so to speak. So we need to build extra systems, electronics, to actually detect the presence of this light very quickly. And only if there's a flash in the night sky that has the right properties, only then do we take this image over a few nanoseconds.
So it's similar kind of equipment to what would be used in particle accelerator experiments in CERN, for example. We're trying to look at the results of these charged particles that are only there for a very, very brief amount of time. So one thing that we do is work on high-speed electronics to be able to detect these very short flashes of light.
Gamma rays arrive upper atmosphere, you get this shower of particles, most which don't get to the surface, but the blue light, this Cherenkov radiation, does get to the surface, and that's what your sensors say, oh, we've got some arrived, we'll open the shutter and you actually image them. How do you decide where to point the telescope?
That's a very good question.
The original theorists predicted that the Crab Nebula might be a source of gamma rays because they could see that there was this remnant of the star that was expanding out into the interstellar medium and that there were shock fronts formed there. So they thought if there's a big shock, then maybe you can accelerate some particles with it.
Right. Yeah.
So that was the thing that we were trying to look at essentially people concentrating on for the first 21 years or so before we actually managed to find it.
Right.
And I forget how many hours the original detection was.
It took a whole winter.
So it was of the order of maybe 30 hours or so.
Yes, of observing time.
Of staring at it before we were able to say we've significantly detected this object.
For comparison, these days with our four telescopes, newer telescopes, we managed to do the same in about 90 seconds.
Oh dear. I remember 1987A, the supernova from 1987, and the then neutrino detectors, I think, detected about half a dozen neutrinos to verify that there was this supernova. You have four telescopes, you mentioned. You do daily observations, so you're detecting Cherenkov radiation on a regular basis.
Part of the reason we're in Arizona is that we need clear skies as far as possible. So I guess we're observing maybe 80% of the time. And the other problem is that we are detecting very, very faint flashes of light. So if the moon is full, we can't use our detector because it is just swamped by the moonlight. So we can only observe on dark nights when there's no moon and no clouds.
So moonlight does interfere with the blue light that you'd be looking for.
Yeah, I mean, moonlight is the whole solar spectrum reflected.
Oh, I see.
So we can't... People have tried to put a filter in to take some of it out, but it doesn't really work because we're only detecting very faint flashes.
Now, you mentioned you were in Arizona, and I think, Joachim, you said there were four telescopes. Is this part of a single project?
It's a single instrument, in a sense, in that these telescopes are linked electronically so that they behave as if they were a single, but much more powerful instrument.
A bit like the VLA or the Merlin at Jodrell Bank.
Yes. In this case, they are more powerful in part because we are actually viewing the light that comes from a spot in the sky, which is about 8 kilometers higher up.
Oh, right. So you actually are looking at the part of the atmosphere, if you like, rather than something
so we're
in space.
We're actually not looking at space, in a sense. We're just looking at something that happens in our own atmosphere.
Right.
And it's a great advantage to view this volume from different points on the ground. You get a stereoscopic view.
So imagine if you close one eye, you sort of lose your depth perception a little bit.
Right.
So by building two or more telescopes, we've got two or maybe four eyes.
Right.
So we can sort of triangulate and work out exactly which direction the flash of light had come from.
Right, that's fascinating. So obviously your telescopes don't need the usual drives that most astronomical telescopes
do. Oh, yes, they do.
Oh, I see.
We have sort of 12-metre diameter telescope, fully mirrored with quite thick glass mirrors, and we need to be able to steer that about.
Well, the particle shower only exists for a few microseconds, but it's the galaxy, say, that emits the high-energy photons, that galaxy, of course, moves across the sky over a night. So we will sometimes start to observe a galaxy.
As well.
And very interestingly, the actual rate at which we see photons from this galaxy changes with time, can be highly variable. So if we find that there is some high level of flux, that there is indication for variability, we may actually continue to observe that galaxy for several hours until eventually it becomes morning and we have to stop observations. Particle showers, the Cherenkov light from particle showers that are triggered by photons that have come from, say, a certain galaxy.
Right.
Very interestingly, what we find, however, is that the rate at which these photons arrive from the galaxy, at which they're entering our atmosphere, is highly variable. We have seen cases where we, at the start of the night, we basically did not detect anything. And then suddenly, half an hour or 1 hour later, that galaxy is the brightest object in the gamma ray sky.
You mentioned the four telescopes. Is that part of the Veritas array we're talking about here?
Yeah, the Very Energetic Radiation Imaging Telescope Array System. If you want to get ahead, you've got to get an acronym.
Of course, it means truth in Latin, I understand.
It
so
does. It's also one of our partners is the Smithsonian Institution, and it's part of their motto.
I see. I thought maybe there's some underlying bigger goal that we're going to find the truth about the universe.
Well, we might find the truth about a few things, but I don't think we'll find the truth about everything.
And you said there's 4 telescopes. Where are they based?
So they're actually just south of Tucson in Arizona. The area around Tucson is actually a hotspot for astronomical tourism, and I expect many of your listeners know.
Yeah.
So it's just across the valley from Kitt Peak, and it's the Hubble Observatory, and it's actually quite near the Mexican border.
And is that where all 4 telescopes are located?
Yes, they are actually about 80 metres apart, sort of in a little grid system.
Yeah. That's Earth-based gamma ray astronomy. I understand there's something called GLAST.
Yes.
What's GLAST?
The Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. This is the next generation satellite detector for gamma rays.
Uh-huh.
Now, the previous detector ran until about 1991, which was Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which is a large mission. Hopefully, on the 16th of May, it is going to be launched.
So less than 2 weeks away.
Yes, I've been waiting for quite a while for this. The way that these telescopes on the satellites work is actually not entirely dissimilar to the ground-based telescopes. What's happening there is that you have a satellite that's maybe about the size of a dining table, say, and a gamma ray will come in and collide with the material that the satellite's made up of.
Right.
And again, it's going to make some secondary charged particles. And because these are lower energy gamma rays, the charged particles that they make have less energy. And you can pretty much trap them in your satellite and work out which direction they came from. So with the ground base, we're using the atmosphere as our big lump of absorbing material, and we're looking at much higher energy gamma rays. From the satellites, you're looking at lower energy gamma rays, and you're trapping them in your satellite as your bit of absorber.
Right.
Okay. So they work at lower energies, so it's sort of overlapping with X-ray satellites at the bottom end of the spectrum.
Right.
And then it's going up to about an order of magnitude less energy than the ones that we look at.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a wider field of view. They can look at more of the sky at one time, whereas our telescopes, we're looking at an area of sky that's only about 3 or 4 degrees across. So we can take the results from the low energy gamma ray satellites that say, this galaxy is very bright tonight, and we can take our telescope and specifically point at that galaxy. And we're looking forward to them coming up with some new sources for us to target.
Presumably, it's the same bunch of astronomers who operate both the ground-based and the in orbit.
It's not necessarily the same physicists doing this,
right.
But we are very, very keen to work together. The two teams have a lot to gain by working together.
Mm.
Satellite can view a large part of the sky, but can pinpoint potentially very interesting objects. And we have a great interest in this because then we can, if we know from the satellite where to look, then we can do far more detailed studies of that object with our telescopes. The one aspect where the telescopes have the advantage is that they detect far more photons, simply because the telescope will see all the photons that fall within about 120-meter radius around the telescope. So imagine basically a few football fields, and you're going to detect every photon that falls somewhere within that area.
See.
The telescope on the satellite, the instrument on the satellite, is about the size of it's about a square meter.
It's a good combination.
Yeah, an advantage that satellites have is maybe looking at gamma ray bursts.
Mm-hmm.
So gamma ray bursts were originally discovered by a satellite because they're looking at a large area of the sky at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So they may just happen to see a gamma ray burst. Whereas with our telescopes, we're only looking at a small area of the sky. It's very, very unlikely that we are going to serendipitously spot a gamma ray burst. But realistically, we're only ever going to manage to move to a new position on the sky in about 20 seconds or so. We may be missing the interesting part of the gamma ray burst by doing that.
Crikey, 20 seconds isn't fast enough. That's amazing. Gamma ray bursts, I think there was a I vaguely remember there was a gamma ray burst which was really energetic, which made it into the optical region a while back. Is there any way that amateur astronomers can get involved here?
Yes, I think so, because some of these bursts have turned out to be so bright that I think there's even one burst that would have been visible with just binocular.
But how long for, though?
Probably talking about hours at most.
Right, yes.
But as far as I know, it's quite possible for anyone to sign up to what is essentially an email distribution list and mm-hmm. receive burst alerts. So that would give us an amateur mm-hmm. The opportunity to the alert right. to look in the right direction. And
the thing that people have used gamma rays for after the supernova explosion is recognizing, again, radioactive elements. So that's slightly lower energy gamma rays, almost into the X-rays, that right. you can see the characteristic decay time of a radioactive element from looking at the gamma rays. Thereby we were able to say, yes, heavier elements are being formed in the supernova explosion. The supernova remnants that we're mapping out in the very high energy gamma rays are things like SN1006, which is obviously about 1,000 years old or so now.
Very fascinating topic, and I know there's so much happening in terms of Veritas and GLASS going up fairly soon. It's a great field to be in. Dr. Joachim Rosa and Dr. Stella Bradbury, thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. AT UK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on AT UK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.